Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. What is a fruit? A fruit is the best. He is constantly training and conditioning himself to meet and overcome all obstacles in his path. His sole purpose is to help to deliver the 17 million or more dead to the Lamb of God, the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad, through the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan Muhammad. To do this, he is compelled to be obedient, tolerant, militant, courteous, humble, honest, dependable. A fruit is obedient to the laws of Islam and those in authority. His conduct is militant. He is humble and submissive. He is tolerant and understanding. He is courteous and respectful. He is honest in thoughts, deeds, and actions. He is alert and dependable.
Fruit of Islam. I am your host, Brother Jihad Muhammad from Atlanta, Georgia. Our topic tonight of discussion, the history of the Nation of Islam. How much do you really know about the Nation of Islam? You read the autobiography of Malcolm X. You have heard many stories and many news stories about the Nation of Islam, but tonight you will hear historian Brother Abdul Akbar Muhammad, the international representative of the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam, as he goes and makes the record straight on the history of the Nation of Islam. And in the second hour, how prepared are you in the case of a natural disaster which could hit your community? Tonight, Brother Rudolph Muhammad, disaster preparedness expert, is here tonight to give you, the listening audience, a test to see how will you fare during a disaster that could hit your community. Also, how does martial law apply when our community has civil unrest or disaster? In queue tonight, Chief Magistrate Court Justice Brother Maurice Muhammad from Birmingham, Alabama, is with us tonight. So sit back and enjoy the last show of the year. Get your comments ready. Get your questions ready. Sit tight. Let's ride. Buckle up. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, I bear witness that there is no God but Allah, and I bear witness that Muhammad is the messenger of Allah. I greet the listening audience and our panel guests tonight with the greetings of peace in paradise of Assalamu Alaikum. Tonight, brothers and sisters in the listening audience, we have a very special guest on the line. He is a longtime servant in the teachings of the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad. He is a strong supporter and friend of the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. He is the international representative of the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan in the Nation of Islam and a historian. We ask you all to sit back and receive our brother, Brother Abdul Akbar Muhammad. Brother Akbar, assalamu alaikum, sir.
Wa alaikum salam.
How are you tonight, sir?
I am doing fine, my brother, and thank you very much for having me on the show.
Oh, the honor is all ours, sir. I have to ask you for the first question is, how is our leader, teacher, and guide, the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, doing?
He is doing excellent, planning, as always, to do some things for the nation and preparing for Savior's Day. But he sends his love and greetings, and he is healing very well. He's feeling 100% compared to how he left the Caribbean, but he's doing well. I spoke to him. His spirit, as always, is very high. I told the minister, you know, we can see you or speak to you on the phone, and we may not be feeling 100%, but by the time we finish that conversation, your spirit has lifted our spirit, and I thank Allah for that kind of spirit in our minister.
All praise is due to Allah. Brother Akbar, if you would, please, please return the greetings to him and let him know that he is always in our prayers and we love him and we're going to do all that we can, sir, to help him because, be honest with you, brother, what he has done for me personally in my life, for my family, is priceless, brother. I could never repay him enough. Let me start you with the first question before we get into the history. Could you give us a little... tell us a little bit about the tour, the Caribbean tour that you were blessed to be on with the minister.
Well, this is the minister's fifth trip in the last 12 months into the Caribbean. And the minister, in 2009, July, he was in Sirte, Libya. He was invited by Brother Muammar Gaddafi to attend the African Union. And at this particular meeting, Brother Gaddafi had invited the leaders of the Caribbean, those who were strong enough to come and were not worried about what America and others would say about them attending a meeting in Tripoli, Libya, invited by Muammar Gaddafi. But at this meeting, Minister Farrakhan had an opportunity to talk to the prime ministers from the Caribbean area, and he talked about his desire to come to the Caribbean to see if he could use the life-giving teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad to help the Caribbean that is right now being challenged with crime and drugs, unemployment among their young people. And it's quite serious in the Caribbean. So what he wanted to do was to come and try to focus on the young people and give them a different idea of how they could be helpful in the Caribbean and how many of them who had been deported from America after being involved in criminal activities, how they could now turn their lives around and begin to help their home countries. So the minister committed. They all welcomed the idea. They wanted to see the minister come. They consider him a son of the Caribbean, being that his mother was from St. Kitts, his father from Jamaica, and they really welcomed him. On one of our trips to the Caribbean, we went by the home of Bob Marley, which is now a museum, to Bob Marley. And the richness of Bob Marley's history and the impact of his music on the conscious movement across the world was really outstanding. But one thing happened as we finished the tour. One of the lady who was really the caretaker of the museum, I wouldn't call it a curator, but she looks out for the museum. She asked the minister this question. She said, you know, minister, two of our great leaders from Jamaica that impacted the entire world came from St. Anne. She said, I wonder if your father came from St. Anne. The two leaders she was talking about was the Honorable Marcus Garvey and Bob Marley.
Wow.
They both came from St. Anne. And Minister Farrakhan, whose life and work now has impacted the entire world, she wanted to know perhaps his father came from St. Anne. But I thought it was an interesting question. So, but this is how this particular trip came about. We planned a certain amount of countries. On this trip, we had planned to actually touch seven countries. Many people, the U.S. Virgin Islands, which is St. Croix, St. Thomas, and St. John, we were going to St. Croix and St. Thomas. Many people don't consider them different countries because they are part of the U.S. Virgin Islands. But I just put it all into seven stops into the Caribbean. The minister actually completed four, but three he was unable to get to the last three. And when he became ill with a low-grade fever and we checked it out, it was time to discontinue the trip and postpone the rest of the countries, as the minister said, not cancel but postpone, because I intend to fulfill my word and to cover the countries that I was not able to get to. And but it was a great trip. It was an unbelievable trip. I said on a blog talk show last week about Minister Farrakhan's first visit to Grenada and Dominica. Grenada was just different for a lot of reasons. First, it was the home of Malcolm X's mother, and which was interesting. So people knew of Malcolm X. Also, it is where in 1983, October the 19th, Maurice Bishop was killed there, and Reagan invaded the island, actually, and took the island over under the guise that he was trying to save some medical students. But it was the politics of the New Jewel Party, which was headed by Maurice Bishop, that was persona non grata in the Western Hemisphere. It was, in other words, it was forbidden by American policy for another country to be established that had socialist policies and a good, strong relationship with Cuba in the socialist world. The Reagan administration would not allow it, and this is why American troops went in and invaded, took over the country, and set up a government that was more pliant to America's idea for the Caribbean.
Beautiful, beautiful. Brother Minister, you know, there is a gap that is developing among the young and the history of the Nation of Islam. Many don't know the history of the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad, the start, the things that he went through to establish Islam in this country. A lot of the other Muslim groups don't know that. Don't know it either. Can I ask you, sir, if you wouldn't mind starting with us tonight and talking about the mission of the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad after Master Farad Muhammad left him with the assignment and take it up into his incarceration?
Yes. Well, first I want to start with how you started the question with the young people, the gap.
And, yes, sir.
Gap only develops in your history when the history is not taught. One thing you have to give America credit for, and right now it's going through that with this horrific killing in Newtown, Connecticut. But America makes sure that in their children coming up through school, public and private school in this country, religious and secular schools, is that they lay the base of the history of the building of the society. Because the citizens of that society have to be endeared to the society in order that they will go up, defend, and protect that society. And it's only a knowledge of the rich history of that society and what that society means to them in their own personal life and their family, their national life, they have to know that history. And the history of Islam in America is lacking. There are some people who are not interested in it, and there are some Muslims who are not interested in it. The foreign Muslims and Muslims that belong to different community, but the bedrock of the growth of Islam in America is actually comes from the Nation of Islam. Some people would like to give Noble Drew Ali, because Noble Drew Ali was a merchant marine. You know, he was from North Carolina. He went to Newark, and he sailed as a merchant marine and went to Morocco and was introduced to aspects of Islam, and he came back fired up. You know, Islam touched him, and he began to teach it. So a lot of people would say, well, it started with Noble Drew Ali. Then there are people who say it was Marcus Garvey. Being that a Muslim taught Marcus Garvey in England. When Marcus Garvey left Jamaica and went to England and worked in that print shop, it was a Muslim brother there who was a Muslim nationalist brother that fed Marcus Garvey and gave him direction, though Marcus Garvey never accepted Islam as a way of life. But Marcus Garvey knew the importance of having a spiritual direction within the movement of the that he started and built, the Universal Negro Improvement Association. So he knew that there had to be a spiritual base, and Marcus Garvey preached that, but it was Islam that was the impetus that drove him. But when Master Farad Muhammad began to teach in Detroit in 1930, he actually built the biggest group of people organized that were Muslims in the history of America. And from there, a lot of things sprang and so forth. Those who know the history remember the Lebanese and the Turks came here. There's evidence of the early Turks here in that Regal Theater in Chicago, up the street from Mosque Miriam. If you look at it, it looks like a mosque. It was the Turks' early mosque. And the Turks built mosques in other parts of the country when they came here to work at the turn of the century. And then Henry Ford, as he began to build an assembly plant in and around Detroit, it was Henry Ford that got the Lebanese community that came to America and ended up settling in what is today Dearborn around Detroit to work in those plants. They were Muslims, but none of them did any dawah work among black people. None of them engaged us. Many of them didn't know anything about us, and many of them felt, being that they were closer to white Americans, that they didn't belong making any contact with us, and forget doing dawah work trying to spread Islam among us. But it was the Good Samaritan, it was Master Farad Muhammad, that work was among the black people of America. And the building of the Nation of Islam, many brothers and sisters do not know that he gave out 25,000 names. He built a tremendous movement in Detroit. And what it was the attracting power of Islam. So this history is important for the young Muslims to know, so that they would understand that the Nation of Islam didn't start with the Million Man March or when they joined in 1997 or 2000, but the nation has an 83-year history, and the gaps in that history, you call it the gaps in that history, has to be filled so that the Muslims would understand that they're standing on the work of people who came forward and joined the nation and made sacrifice, had to sometimes fight, donated their money, went to the mosques, went into the highways and the byways and fished people to hear this word that would change their life, would change the course of their life. And their brothers and sisters that worked on that, and these are the stars in Allah's crown, those who laid the foundation of the Nation of Islam, that we can stand. It is important that as young Muslims coming in, that you know the history of your nation. When I was a young Muslim, when I first accepted Islam in New York in 1960, I lived in Queens at the time that I accepted. I grew up in the South Bronx. But I'll never forget when I went around my neighborhood and I was talking what I had heard at the mosque and preaching to everybody I ran into. They used to call me Muslim Larry. But one of my friends that I grew up with, he became a Jehovah's Witness. And at the time that I became a Muslim. So we would lock horns over religion. I'm preaching Islam. He's talking about Jehovah and the kingdom of Jehovah that was coming. And what I realized, I didn't know the Bible as well as he did. But I realized that he didn't know the history of his organization. So I went and studied it. I found a book called Inside the Jehovah Witness. I read that book, and I found out what year they started, who was their first leader, what year they changed their name to Jehovah Witness, who became their leader at that time. And so I read their history. And then when we met and we were clashing and he was using Bible scripture and I'm trying to tell him about Islam, then I used his history on him. And I asked him a question. The first question I asked, what year did your movement start? He was a little foggy. He wasn't sure. I said, and what did they call themselves when they started? You know, they were Russellites. And after Charles Taz Russell, their founder. And then I said, well, what was the position of black people within the movement in 1872 when he founded? See, he didn't know this. And I asked him a few more questions. Why did they change their name to Jehovah's Witness? What year did it happen? And who was in charge of the movement? He knew none of that. I said, before you start trying to beat up me on that Bible, you go out and find the history of the movement that you belong to. This stuck with me, and it made me to know that if you are a Muslim in the Nation of Islam, a follower of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, then you should know the history of your movement. You should be able to tell them when Master Farad Muhammad came. Did he come right here? Was he in America before? How did he start teaching? How many people did he convert? What was the first newspaper that he had? How did he give out the names? About the identity cards and whatnot. What year did he leave? And when he left, what happened in the Nation of Islam? Was there any problem or was there a smooth transition? Did people challenge the leadership of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad? Why did the Honorable Elijah Muhammad leave Detroit and begin to move around the country? Because there were people who felt that they could do better. See, all of this is the history of your movement. And our problem today, and I am guilty of it too, I'm working on my book now, but we don't write our own history, so somebody else writes it. And those that write it are read by people outside of us who are trying to understand us, but it's not from our pen. It's not from our experience. It's not from the depth of the knowledge that we know. And it's not a bearing of witness to the power of the word of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. You know, I was speaking somewhere, and I mentioned, you know, Minister Farrakhan came in the nation in 1955. And, you know, I pride myself in this history. Those who know me and have been around me, they know I have a love of history. You know, a doctor may have a love of medicine, an engineer his engineering, whether he's an electrical engineer, a chemical engineer, you know, but his field is engineering. So people have their fields and their specialties. My specialty is history. I love contemporary African history, world history, and I love the history of the Nation of Islam, that I think that I can articulate it, I can talk about it. But we have to produce from our own ranks, from the brothers and sisters who have gone through this experience, we have to produce our own body of literature. There's nothing wrong with a Muslim sitting down to write. You don't have to be a scholar. All you have to do writing is sharing your experience, sharing your knowledge, you know, sharing what you went through. That's what writing is. But out of the Nation of Islam, there must come a body of literature. I told a group of people recently that when the history is written of Barack Obama, he will probably go down in history as the president, while in office, more books were written about him than any other president in the history of America. And the amount of them that is negative is unbelievable.
But wow.
Book on the I didn't even know. I went to the library. I had to speak to a group of senior citizens right before the election. And I went to the library to get a list of all of the books written on Barack Obama. She didn't even have all of them in the library, but she gave me 18 of them 18 books, and that was just a few. There were many more. So a body of literature is produced about him, describing him, of how they see him. And Barack Obama has written two books. There's a book written that's a positive book about him, but most of the books that are written about him are negative books where people describe him. And I only use that to say that on this line there are Muslims who have been in the nation some 10, 15, 20 years, some 30 years. You have an experience. You know, you say, well, it's not my place. It is your place. It's your place to share with the world your experience coming into the nation. So out of the nation of Islam, those who today follow the leadership of Minister Farrakhan, the man that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad told us to look at, follow him, listen to him. And so the followers of Minister Farrakhan have an obligation. And if it's not for world consumption, it's for the consumption of your family, your children, your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren, so they can read that my father was a part of the Nation of Islam. He came in 1985. He worked in Baltimore under this brother, or he worked in New York or Boston or Miami. And during that time, my father had three children. They were raised as Muslim. My father had a post in the mosque. My father was a seller of the Final Call newspapers, or the Muhammad Speaks. And my father taught us this lesson as a follower of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. I just wrote an editorial tonight about this killing, a tragic killing, six-year-old children. Mm-hmm. And in the editorial that I wrote, I was saying that the British are not coming, nor the Russians coming, and the Second Amendment should really be discarded. And when they did the Second Amendment, they had muskets. They had guns that took almost 5 minutes to load and couldn't hit anything. Mm-hmm. So you can say that everybody, you know, the right to bear arms, because the arms that you banned, it could barely do anything.
Right.
And, but they never saw that over 200 years later there would be a gun that in 3 minutes could fire 100 rounds or more. Guns that are mass killers. They never saw that. So I closed my article out by saying that I thank God for the Honorable Elijah Muhammad that brought us up in a no-gun culture.
That's right.
Not to carry guns or to have guns in our home. And I'm sure if we were armed, there would have been a lot of killing within the movement, but because we wanted to be obedient to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, I didn't raise my children with guns in the house. They never saw a gun in the house. And I used to tell them when they're young, we don't carry guns. And those are the words of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. We believe in Allah. We are realists. But we know what guns do. If you got a gun, I got a gun. And the kind of anger that we have and how dysfunctional our families are, then we would end up shooting someone. So even that aspect of the history of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad in the nation is important as we see what is happening in this country. So let me just move. On the time that I'm on here, and especially if I'm going to take a few callers, I can't cover all of the history, but there's aspects of it that
are
important ingredients of history. And for the brothers, sisters who are on the line listening to me, and you've often heard me say this, I would say when you go to a mosque lecture somewhere, if you don't like history, then there's no need of coming out to hear Akbar. I'm going to teach, but my subjects will always be woven with a part of history. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad said, of all of our studies, history is most attractive and deserves all of our research as it develops the springs and the motives that act most powerfully on the destiny of men and women. So whenever you hear a lecture by me at any mosque, my lecture will always be peppered with aspects of history, and that's my passion for history. Dr. Alim will always teach, and he'll always have something in there about what he learned in medicine, you know. And people, whatever their specialty is, my specialty is history. So this rich history, 83-year history of the Nation of Islam, and it's no one history, you know, the definitive history of the Nation of Islam. There's a book that just came out like 4 months ago or less called A History of the Nation of Islam by a white woman in Ireland. She's a PhD, and I think her PhD thesis was the Nation of Islam. And she must have spent the last 10 or 12 years writing this book. But it goes into aspects of the nation, but she misses a whole section. And in reading the book, I can see there's aspects of the nation's history that she just doesn't know. I don't think she left it out on purpose. In her interviews, she's writing this book from England, from Ireland, and she's interviewing people by phone and reading, but she put together a book that she calls A History of the Nation of Islam, a picture of Minister Farrakhan on the front, and her editor and whatnot has a picture with the minister with his mouth open, you know, when the minister's making a point, as they usually do. But the writing of that book is another aspect of people who are writing about us, and we're not writing about ourselves. So when you were in school in America, if you went to school in America, in elementary school, and they actually started, as I remember, I went to school in New York. In the third grade, I was learning about George Washington. I was learning, they had little children's books, and we would read about George Washington, the first president. And they would tell you about his life and what role he played in the development of America and in American history, but they would also tell you about him personally. And so when they walked through his life, you grew up knowing what George Washington did and what he contributed to the building of your nation, America, as they would say. So what about us? The building, and this endeared in the young American boy, and idea number one, what he could become, the idea number two of the impact of individuals on the history of a society, and it endeared loyalty, and it endeared in them the idea of greatness of men who believed in a cause bigger than themselves, and that was the development of this society. So in the Nation of Islam, you cannot get away from that in building your society. If you don't have a sense of where your society came from, when the Honorable Elijah Muhammad got out of prison and had a little store in Chicago, and he worked in the store himself, putting cans on the shelf and selling it to the believers. But he had a vision of where that would go. These are aspects of how your nation was built. So when the Savior left, and the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and he gave it to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, there were those that challenged his leadership. There were those who thought they were smarter than the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, could speak better than the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. It wasn't how smart they were or what degrees they had or how they could speak. It was the quality of the heart. And the quality of the heart determined how the Savior chose that person who would be in front of his people for 44 years before he left us in 1975. But look at the history of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad in spreading this word. Immediately there were those who wanted to take his life. And so he started moving around the country. And wherever he moved, he was planting seeds. He was teaching. And I so happened when I moved to St. Louis after he left us, when I was transferred here, a doctor who saved one of our brothers, a minister named Clyde X, later became known as Clyde Rockman, who was the minister in St. Louis, was shot in the head. And they didn't think he would make it, and if he made it, he would be a vegetable. But two doctors operated on him, two black doctors, Dr. Spencer and Dr. Eugene Mitchell. Both of them have since passed. Dr. Mitchell became very close to the nation and helped Minister Farrakhan in the rebuilding. He owned a newspaper, and our early final calls, he printed them, charged us, and then said, forget it. and he helped us to get started. But one day I was sitting with Dr. Spencer, the neurosurgeon, and Dr. Spencer told me that I operated on Clyde Rockman. People didn't think he would make it. They removed the bullet from his head, and he went on to function. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad transferred him to Baltimore, where he became a mighty minister for the nation in the early days. But Dr. Spencer told me this, and it was really amazing for me as a historian to hear this. He said, you know, my family was from Fort Wayne, Indiana, and I think his father owned this barbershop in Fort Wayne, or his father used to take him to this barbershop. And he said that a man used to come in there named Mr. Mustafa. And he said that, and he would come in there, and he would be teaching us in the barbershop. He said when he finished medical school and he saw the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, as the Honorable Elijah Muhammad came to St. Louis in the early days, he said that this is the man who used to call himself Mr. Mustafa, who used to come in the barbershop. I believe it was his father's barbershop. And used to come there. This was Fort Wayne, Indiana. So the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was moving around the country, and wherever he go, even though people were trying to take his life, he was planting seeds, he was teaching. Now, those seeds may not have germinated in the ones that he was talking to, but the Honorable Elijah Muhammad planted seeds in the brains of those individuals, and some of those men had children, and some of those children became followers in the Nation of Islam. But the history is rich of what he had to do to keep the nation going. And from 1934, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad started moving. You know, he was on the East Coast. Most of the Muslims in the nation heard Minister Farrakhan teach about when the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was becoming frustrated with the mission. And it looked like, you know, Negroes are hard-headed, and we know that very well. And this is
yes, sir.
Truth that could wake our people up, but yet and still they were not listening. And one time the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was on a train. Some people said he was leaving Philadelphia heading to Baltimore. Some people said he was leaving Baltimore heading to Philadelphia. And I hope to get to the bottom of that one way or another. But the Honorable Elijah Muhammad sat on that train. And according to the way he shared this story with those at his table, he was wanted to give up. He wanted to just give up the mission. And he said as he sat on that train and out of the wheels of the train came, he heard the 29th surah of the Holy Quran, the spider. Do men think that they would be left alone on saying that we believe and not be tried? And certainly Allah will try us so that Allah would know those who are truthful from the liars. And the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said that alone put him back on his mission, and he went on and kept moving. Then in 1942, he was arrested. Most people said April or May. May has been, some people say it was early April, but the FBI, the newspaper, took a picture of him. And so in my looking at history, they arrested him because America had a war to win. And the Japanese knew, once the war started, the Japanese knew that the black people in America were mistreated. And they seized that opportunity. And there was a Japanese general named Takahari who was sent into America. And Takahari began to talk to the black people about not joining and fighting in the war. And now, I knew about this history, but one day I was in the bookstore, and most people that know me, you know I love books, and, you know, I always find my home in a bookstore or a library. And I'm a book collector. When people come and they see the books, a young man was in my house recently, and he said, "Man, have you read all those books?" I said, "No, I haven't read all of them." I said, "But I collect books." I said, 90% of them I've looked into. But I was looking in a book called War Without Mercy. And, you know, it was about the war with Japan. So I'm going through the book, and I run into a section about black people, and it mentions this Japanese general. Now, I had only heard it talked about off the rostrum, but had never read anything in writing. And when I got the book and opened it up, lo and behold, in the book it talked about General Takahari and how he was coming among the black people. talking to them about this war and how they shouldn't be engaged in it. So the FBI knew that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said that we don't fight in any war that has not been declared by Allah, and America needs to give us something to fight for. The injustice heaped on our people, why should we go to war and kill the Japanese or the Germans for them when we don't have justice? So the American government knew that they had to take him off the street. And so they arrested the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And they sought to break up the movement, and they arrested a lot of the top brothers in ranks, went to jail with the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and it was Sister Clara Muhammad, his wife, that was the lifeline to keep the few believers together. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad got out of jail in late, went in 42, got out in late 1946. And when he got out, he first went to Detroit for a little while, then he went to Chicago. And from Chicago, he began to rebuild the nation. In 6 years, between 46 and 52, because in 52, Malcolm X came out of jail. But while Malcolm was in jail, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad would write letters to him. He would send the brothers $5 to help them out. And Malcolm became a convert, of jail and began to help the Honorable Elijah Muhammad to build a nation. And we went through a terrible period starting in late 1963. And I'm not going to try to cover every single aspect of it, but I just want to give the sense of this history. It would take a few programs, but I just want to go through this part because it's just important. When Malcolm came out of jail, their objective was to spread the teachings and the words of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. The enemy saw, it was right at the time of the Civil Rights Movement, and Taylor Branch and his three landmark books on the civil rights struggle. The second book has a whole section about the Nation of Islam in the South, and they talk about Jeremiah and so forth. But during the days of the Civil Rights Movement, the nation was building, but the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was drawing such tremendous crowds. So they wanted to find out what was it about this black man from Chicago coming from Georgia that were drawing these large crowds. Why were people going out to hear him? And what they were describing, that he was a hate teacher. So Mike Wallace took on to produce the hate that hate produced in 1959. And it was really designed to denigrate the Honorable Elijah Muhammad's work, to throw a stone at it, but it opened up the eyes of millions of our people across the country, and their curiosity set in. You know, we have a saying in the street, curiosity killed a cat, but satisfaction brought him back. So our people were curious. And so it started a kind of movement towards listening to the Nation of Islam. Many of the great thinkers and many of the brothers who engaged in the civil rights struggle got involved in the nation or were listeners to the nation or were inspired by the nation and moved by the nation. And when Malcolm was on point and good, Malcolm did a lot of good work for the Nation of Islam. I recited this history to some of the brothers when we were in the Caribbean, how Malcolm sent brothers out from New York to open mosques all across the country, the mosques on the West Coast. It was brothers from Mosque No. 7 in New York who got in cars and went out there and started the teaching. And I was using that history to inspire the brothers in the Caribbean. The minister is loved in the Caribbean. He's well known in the Caribbean. He's respected. He's opened the doors in the Caribbean. So I was using the history of the nation to inspire brothers to go down there. And after the minister opened the door, some soldiers got to step in and organize and move things. And this is how I used that history. So by 1963, there were rumblings in the nation. And, you know, there's a poem, an English poem written, unknown author, because I could never find the author, but I learned it when I was in school. It says, what a little thing would make the world go wrong? A smile too short, a laugh too long. Then comes the blinding rain, and things are never the same again. So the killing of Kennedy is what started it. It started right before, and those, you can read this in your message to the black man, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was in Flint, Michigan. And in Flint, Michigan, there was a big meeting. The hall was packed. And the police chief of the Flint wanted to come into our meeting with his weapons and some of his men. So they tried to stop him at the door. They couldn't. He insisted. So they called Raymond Sharif, the supreme captain, off the rostrum. He went to try to negotiate with him. They reached a stalemate. Raymond Sharif went back to the rostrum and actually had to interrupt the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and tell him what was happening. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad turned to the audience and told the audience that there's a police want to come into our meeting with a weapon, and we don't allow weapons in our meeting. And the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said, so this meeting is dismissed. In the middle, he stopped the meeting, and he got in the car to drive back to Chicago. In the car was Malcolm's brother, Wilford, Malcolm X, Minister Farrakhan, and the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and one other person that I don't know. But in that car, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad gave instructions. And the instructions was, you know, we've always opened our public meetings to white people to come in if they desire, and we welcome them. He said, but for this day forth, they will not be allowed in our public meeting, except for the people from countries. He mentioned Turkey and other countries, mainly in the Muslim world. These people appear white, but they could come in our meeting.
What year is that, Brother Akbar?
October 1963.
Okay.
And that September, we went to Philadelphia. New York took 26 buses. We had the largest caravan of buses. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad was speaking in Philly. It was September 1963. And Malcolm had told us in New York, he said he's going to ask the messenger to come to New York. I think the messenger hadn't been there since 61. That was the first time I think I met Minister Farrakhan. Malcolm, after the meeting, Malcolm, evidently he asked the messenger, and he walked down the bus line, and he was telling all of the believers that the messengers agreed he would come to New York, and we were all cheering because we wanted to lay the city out for him. And we got back to New York. We began planning. And we ended up getting, we couldn't get the armory, which we usually get for him in Harlem. For some reason, we couldn't get it. And so we ended up with Manhattan Center on 34th Street and 8th Avenue. And the date we set was December the 1st, 1963. And so we were planning for it, building for it. But on November the 22nd in Dallas, Texas, John F. Kennedy is killed. And when John F. Kennedy is killed, it is a problem. They wanted to, we were going to cancel. They didn't want to give us our money back. So the Honorable Malcolm went out to see the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, because when Kennedy was killed, we had special instructions not to say anything about his death, about Kennedy's death. And as gung-ho as we were at that time, we would be saying it was good for the devil. He got it and so forth. You know, because Malcolm used to call him John the Fox, Kennedy. And so,
yes,
so the Honorable Elijah Muhammad gave Malcolm permission to carry the meeting forward, and that we were to be careful. That day, I happened to be the person assigned by Shaw, a brother named John D., and myself, to go to Malcolm's home and follow him to Manhattan Center. And when we arrived at Manhattan Center, we pulled up to the parking lot garage that's right next to Manhattan Center on 34th Street and 8th Avenue. In the car with Malcolm in the back seat was Harriet Muhammad, who was married to Akbar Muhammad, the messenger's youngest son, by Sister Clara Muhammad. She had just came back from Egypt, where they were living, and they were just divorced. And when Malcolm got out the car, Captain Shaw came up to him. I was standing right there behind him, and Captain Shaw said, Handler, this is a man that was a reporter for the New York Times that usually covered the events of the Nation of Islam or Malcolm in New York. He came to come in, And Shaw said, we turned him around. And Malcolm said to go get him and bring him back. Let him in. Okay? That was mistake number one, because he was not to be permitted in the meeting. Handler came in, took a seat. Malcolm delivered a brilliant address, and a man got up at the end. I can see his face to this day. He had a black jacket on, receding bald hair a little, and he raised his hand when Malcolm closed out. Malcolm, I believe, if my memory serves me right, it was 1963, Malcolm opened the floor for questions. And this man raised his hand, stood up, and he said, Minister Malcolm, would you care to comment on the death of President John F. Kennedy? Malcolm dropped his head. There was silence. Took him a look. It was probably just 30 seconds to a minute, but it looked like it was much longer. And when his head came up, Malcolm said, being an old farm boy myself, chickens coming home to roost never made me sad. It always made me glad. And the crowd just applauded, and Malcolm didn't take any more questions. He walked off the stage. Handler, sitting in that audience, wrote this down in the front page of the New York Times the next day, that Monday. A little box on the front, Malcolm X compares Kennedy's death as chickens coming home to roost. And when the Honorable Elijah Muhammad saw that, he had to silence Malcolm. He didn't take him off his post, but he had to come out publicly and condemn that statement from Malcolm. And there was two levels of disobedience there, one letting him in, and two making a public comment about the death of John F. Kennedy. Now, this is history. I'm not saying this because Malcolm turned against our leader and I don't like Malcolm. This is a fact of history. And most people don't want to face it. One man wrote a book saying that Malcolm did this at a press conference. He had to call the press conference and call Kennedy's deaf chickens coming home to roost. Absolute distortion of historical facts. The total distortion. And this is what began the slide. Then, and I'm going to close out because we have about 10 minutes that I can stay.
Yes, sir.
But I want to close out on this. And maybe a few callers have some questions that I can answer. Now, this is the history of the nation. They made a movie on Malcolm. The greatest to me, there's a lot of distortions in the movie and problem with Spike Lee's, but it's how the world shaped how they viewed Malcolm and the Nation of Islam. The first distortion of the picture is that they left Minister Louis Farrakhan, then known as Louis X, completely out of the whole thing, as close as it involved as Minister Farrakhan was in the life of Malcolm. Malcolm was his mentor. Minister started in New York. It was Malcolm that sent him to Boston. It was Malcolm that took him as his confidant and talked to the minister, but no mention of the minister in that movie. The second distortion in the movie is Malcolm in Africa. They only showed Malcolm one time riding a camel in Africa. And then the way that they pictured the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. So nobody walked away from that movie in love with the Nation of Islam that redeemed Malcolm when he was a thug in prison. It twisted it. So what happened is Malcolm is relieved from his post for 90 days. He still had his post. He was still the minister because he used to come to the restaurant. We used to bring his mail down. He would sit in the restaurant, but he was not to publicly speak in the mosque. He was the minister of the mosque. So during this time, Ali had the fight with Sonny Liston that February, 1964. And Ali invited Malcolm down to Miami. Most of you have read a part of this or seen it in film. And you know what happened? Ali beat Liston. Malcolm was in the camp. They were going to call the fight off because the white promoter said that Ali had to get this Malcolm X out of his camp. And Ali refused. And I give him credit. He stood up. And all the people were saying, oh, you're going to ruin this and so forth. and Ali stood his ground, so Malcolm invited his family down. He stayed there. After the fight, Malcolm came back to New York, left his family in Florida for a little vacation, and a reporter, one of the first black reporters for ABC, named Nell Good, I believe it was ABC, met Malcolm at the airport and asked Malcolm would he care to comment on the Ali fight, the Cassius Clay, as he was known then, fight. And Malcolm stepped before the microphone, that was violation number 3, and made a comment, a decent comment, but it was in violation with the Honorable Elijah Muhammad had instructed him not to make any public appearance, you know, press or public speaking for 90 days. Then the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, at that time, had no other choice but to remove him from the post as the minister of Mosque number 7.
Wow.
316 wow. days later, well, not from that day, that was February the 22nd. The fight was on the 21st. About the 23rd or 24th. Then on March the 8th, 1964, Malcolm called a press conference at the New York Hilton Hotel and said that he was separating from the Nation of Islam. He still believed in the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. He still believed that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad's solution to the problem of the Negro is correct. You can read this yourself by going to the archives of the New York Times. And he separated from the nation 316 days later. Malcolm was brutally assassinated, and the nation had to carry that weight. But that's all. We have about 4 minutes.
Yes, sir. But I do have one text so far coming out of Newark, New Jersey. They wanted to know about Minister James Shabazz, the son of Thunder, and the establishment of 25 around that time.
Yes. Well, first, Minister James Shabazz went to prison with the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. He was in construction. Malcolm started the mosque in Newark, New Jersey. And then when Malcolm, because a lot of these mosques Malcolm started, like in Philadelphia, but we had to have ministers there who would carry it on. So Minister James Shabazz was appointed by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and he became his minister. As you know, he was brutally assassinated in his driveway of his home. But when Malcolm was sit down from his post at that time, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad sent James Shabazz to New York to hold down New York until the Honorable Elijah Muhammad appointed Minister Farrakhan from Boston, who was Louis X at that time.
Do you know anything about the Honorable Elijah Muhammad giving Newark his number? Because that's always been an ongoing discussion. When he gave Newark the mosque number 25, it was said that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said he would give Newark his number. Do you know anything about the significance or did that take place?
I don't know. I can certainly find out.
Yes, sir.
Newark got his number quite naturally. All numbers came from Chicago. You know, we didn't give out, number 7 didn't give out numbers. Numbers came from headquarters.
Okay.
And, but I will try to find out. If Brother Jihad, if you remind me, or Brother Maurice, if you're on the line, then I will call one of the brothers who was instrumental, Dr. Abdul Salam. He was there. He was one of the first ministers in forming the mosque, and he worked with Malcolm when Malcolm would come over from New York. And I will ask him exactly how Newark got its number 25.
Okay, sir, there's a caller on the line. Brother Vernon, you got one for Brother Akbar before he goes? You got about 4 minutes, 773 number? Brother Vernon?
Yes, sir, 773-999.
Yes, go ahead, 773. Well, alaikum salam, sir.
Hey, Muhammad. Yes, sir, I'd like to say to Brother Akbar, thank you so very much, brother, for coming on our network and letting the believers know more about our history, which most of us, or shall I say a lot of us, know very little of. And I really appreciate you, and I appreciate Brother Jihad for doing such a wonderful job, brother, as always. This is so beautiful, brother. I could almost cry just listen to Brother Akbar, because Brother Akbar is so important in this movement, in this nation. And brother,
yes.
I Allah is enough for you, brother.
Oh, praise
brother Akbar, this is Brother Rakim. He's the CEO of the network that we're on. And Sister Gidget, did you have a question before Brother Akbar goes? Is she there?
Yes, sir, I'm here. No, I didn't have a question. I just wanted to once again thank Brother Minister Akbar for coming on to the network, and we really appreciate it. We're very honored by your presence, sir. Thank you so much. And it has been such a historical moment and a historical lesson as well. Thank you so much.
Yes.
Well, thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, my sister. I consider this my duty, being that my specialty and my love of history and the history of my nation, and I feel that after 52 years in the nation, I have this duty and responsibility to the younger and the new believers.
Brother Akbar, if I can ask you, sir, if there's so much that I wanted to cover with you, is there any way that you can come back at a later date, maybe 2 weeks or 3 weeks, whatever is convenient for you? Because I wanted to talk to you about the establishment, because the Honorable Louis Farrakhan said that there were four major cities that must stand open as pillars. He named New York, L.A., Atlanta, and Chicago, and he said, if possible, Detroit.
Right, that's correct.
That's correct. So I wanted to talk to you when you at another time about the establishment of those four cities, which makes it important for why those pillars have to stand. But we don't have enough time tonight, and I was hoping that maybe you can come back and do a part two.
Right. Do you have Brother Bryant's number? Brian,
Yes, sir, we have it. Brother Maurice has it.
Okay. Call Brother Brian. Brother Brian handles helping me to set up dates. And if
okay.
I was in the country at that time, I would be happy. And it would have to be after the 15th of January.
Okay.
I'll be traveling,
yes, sir,
inshallah, overseas to Ghana for the inauguration of the new president. When I return, Brother Brian could help set up a date.
Brother Akbar, thank you so much, sir, for coming on tonight. This has really been an eye-opener, because I heard some things I didn't know about the in 1963, about when the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said that whites wouldn't be allowed in the meetings anymore from that point on. And also, I wanted to get to you, but we'll catch you another time, the establishment of the what the Muslims want and what the Muslims believe, how the Honorable Elijah Muhammad came up with that, but we can get that at another time. And inshallah, I'll call Brother Brian, and I'll straighten it out, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, and thank you to all of the believers who are on the line. And
yes, sir.
Pay your greetings to the minister when I talk to him the next time. Thank you again, and may Allah bless you. Keep up the good work so we can continue to tell our story.
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. As-salamu alaykum.
Wa alaykum salam. You are out on the front line with the fruit of Islam. That was Abdul Akbar Muhammad, the international representative of the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam. Praise be to Allah. Brother Vernon, is there anybody that would like to make a comment that's on the line right quick before we go to the second portion of our meeting?
Yes, sir. We have a few callers on the line with their hand raised. There's a caller from area code 507.
Okay.
Phone is open.
507. Well, alaykum salam. Well,
alaykum salam. How you doing, brother?
I'm fine.
Sister Gidget,
I'm doing fine.
Alhamdulillah, brother. I'm just kicked back, enjoying the show. You guys are really getting the show is developing nicely, and I've been enjoying myself listening to the history. And I really enjoyed hearing what Brother Akbar had to say tonight, and
yes.
I didn't get a chance to ask my question tonight, so I'll be to Brother Akbar, but I'll try and catch him next time he comes, inshallah.
Yes, sir.
January 15th. But I just today I was looking at a YouTube video. My sister had posted a YouTube video It was a lecture. I can't remember exactly who was lecturing, but you know, when that video ended, it had a list of other videos, and this video started off with Bruce Lee coming in the video, and he was talking about his teacher having been killed. And so then that led up to it was a small autobiography talking about the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. I think it was in 1973, 74, 75, when he went down to Mexico and got sick with pneumonia or flu or something, and it was something like an assassination or a murder that took place that happened in the hospital. And it kind of reminded me of a couple of weeks ago on Twitter where I had posted responded to the ministers when he opens up for questions. I sent a question to him and just asked him how was his trip going in the Caribbean, and he chose it as a favorite. And so when I was looking at these two comparisons and contrasts, I found it later. I discovered later that week that the minister had to end his trip in the Caribbean from being sick. So one of the questions that I had wanted to ask tonight was, how was the minister doing with his health, and would he be carrying his own medical team and dietitian with him as he travels? And I think that's something that's really crucial, knowing that the enemy would like to do anything that they can to destroy the mission of the nation. And so I felt that would be the questions that I wanted to ask. But inshallah, maybe I'll get a chance.
Yes, sir, brother.
Enjoying the shows, some beautiful shows, brother.
Oh, thank you, sir. Thank you, soldier. I really appreciate you calling in. And you hold on to that, because, inshallah, we will have him back in a few weeks, and we will continue on for part two of the history of the Nation of Islam. Thank you for your call, sir. Let me go ahead. Brother Vernon, is Brother Rudolph on the line?
Brother Rudolph is, in fact, on the line. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
All praise is due to Allah. How about Brother Maurice? Is he on the line?
I believe Brother Maurice is on the line as well. His mic is open.
All right. Well, brothers and sisters, let's get on to the next part of the show. And this part of the show is going to really, it should really wake you up to recognize what's going on and just what to do about it. Brother Rudolph, how are you, sir?
All praise is due to Allah, beloved. I'm on this side of the dirt, so I'm not complaining.
All praise is due to Allah. Brother Rudolph, tell us a little something about yourself and your field and what you do, sir.
Well, by profession, I'm a practical nurse and an emergency medical technician instructor in New York. I've worked with the New York City Fire Department for about 23 years. I was in the United States Navy. I was a corpsman and a disaster specialist there. And I'm the commanding officer of the nation, the world's only Black and Latino Volunteer Ambulance Corps, the Denver Stuyvesant Volunteer Ambulance Corps, started by my father in July 15, 1988. And I've been there with him since day one. And this is just something that I fell into, because I really had no clue that I was going to get into the field of disaster preparedness or the medical field. So
okay.
I don't know how I got here other than the direction of Allah.
Well, let me start here, sir. The Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad told us that the calamities were coming. And
yes,
he said,
sir,
that America was first on God's list to be judged. So we already know that disasters are going to take place. But my biggest fear, sir, well, not a fear, but biggest concern that I have, is that many of us have not taken that serious. And so if you ask the question, how many of us have 6 months of supply of food stored in our homes, the numbers are very low. So I want to ask you, sir, what are some of the concerns that you see with disaster preparedness that is not being addressed, and what can we do about it right now?
One of the main, let me go with your question. Here are some of my concerns. One, we know disasters are coming, they're happening on a regular. We, as a people, as a family, have still not taken on the responsibility of doing for self. We complain about the Red Cross and what they're not doing, but we have not done anything either. We complain about the Red Cross squandering the money that people are giving them for disasters, but where is our National Disaster Relief Fund? The Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan called for it after the Millions War Movement.
Mm-hmm.
Where is it? And that's mm-hmm. no slight on him, because he did his job. He instructed
right.
us to do it. We dropped the ball on it. And so now we have to suffer for it. And our children, unfortunately, have to suffer for it because we were lax and lackadaisical in our carrying on the job that we needed to do. Secondly,
okay.
is training. Again, we are looking at everybody else and we are complaining or pointing the finger at other groups because, like when Katrina happened, they blocked the bridge and wouldn't let them over the bridge. I wouldn't
right.
have either, brother. Personally, I would not have either. And I worked to prepare my community for a day when a disaster is coming, and I have my community or my household or my area tight and secured. I'm not letting you in either to cause havoc in my secured area.
Okay.
This is like the old fable of the grasshopper and the ant. When the ants are storing up for the winter and the grasshopper is walking along singing, "Oh, the world holds me a living." And so when the winter comes, now the grasshopper is out there freezing, knocking, trying to get somebody to give him something for something that he should have done for himself.
Okay. Now, let me ask the question this way. There are different types of disasters. Are there different ways to prepare for the different type of disasters? For example, flood versus earthquake, tornadoes versus hurricanes. Are there different ways, or is there a basic common way that you can prepare for it all? Well, earthquakes, is, I guess, is just out of the question, but go right ahead, sir, and answer that the best way you feel best to answer that.
I'll say it this way. Yes, there are different disasters. You have man-made disasters. You have technological disasters. You have natural disasters.
Okay.
The commonality with all three of them are you and the fact that you are in the middle of it. The way that you try and mitigate or prepare for them is specific to the region you live in, what your ability for resources are, what your educational level is, and then what your physical capability and ability is. So that's where the differences come. But as far as your response to it, no, that's the same for all of them. You prepare for them by becoming aware of what your vulnerabilities and hazards are. You prepare
okay.
for it by trying to prepare for the worst case scenario, and then you train for the drills that may help you to survive that particular thing. But make no mistake about it, surviving the disaster is in Allah's hand. So if he blesses
right.
you to survive it, now comes the part that you have to do, and that you have to live now after the survival.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, give me and the listening audience a test, if you will, to survive it, what you need to have stored, or what do you need to have in order to survive after that. Can you give us a list and give us an exam, okay, so to speak, so that we can check off the list to see if we got these things, or if we don't, that way we can deduct and let us know what are our chances of surviving such a disaster.
Okay, yeah, let's go with this little quiz, pop quiz, real quick.
Okay.
And now, for all of these questions, the framework is we're talking about right here, right now. Not tomorrow, not what you're going to do, not what you're capable of doing. We're talking about is it done right here, right now. All right?
Okay.
That's the premise. Do you have at least 1 gallon of drinking water per person that's in your house stored up? And again, now we're talking, let's just make it easy, and let's talk for 5 days. Okay? We're just going to talk for five days,
okay.
Yes. So do you have 1 gallon of drinking water per person per day stored up? That's the first question.
Okay. I hope everybody's listening and writing this down. Get your checklist out. Yes, sir. Go right ahead, sir.
The second question, how much food do you have stored in your home in the event you had to stay inside and could not go outside? Is there enough food in your home to last for 5 days for everyone that's in your household?
Okay, that's two.
Okay, the next one, supplies. Now, when I'm talking about supplies, I'm talking about cleaning supplies, sanitation supplies, because, again, if you're talking about staying in your house for 5 days, that means you have to use the bathroom. You have to eliminate. You have to, let the stuff out. What is your plan for that? Do you have cat litter in the house? Do you have large, strong garbage bags in the house? Do you have a shovel in the house that you can go out into the backyard and then dispose of this human waste after it builds up? So do you have a way to dispose of human waste in a sanitary manner?
Okay. All right.
Okay. The next one is along the same lines. We're talking about sanitary hygiene conditions. How will you keep your environment clean and sanitary while you're stuck in there with everyone that's in your house? Because, again, that's the first casualty in a disaster is personal hygiene. And once personal hygiene goes, now here comes the infecting of everybody else with disease.
Okay. That's how much that number before.
Okay. Here's the next one.
Okay.
The next one is the climate that you live in. Do you have adequate supplies? If you're in a cold zone, do you have adequate supplies to keep yourself warm in case you lose electricity and the ability to turn your heater or your boiler on? If you're in a warm climate or a hot climate, do you have adequate supplies to keep yourself cool? And along with that is appropriate clothing for the climate that you live in. So that would be number five.
Okay.
Number six, do you have a plan that has been rehearsed and practiced with the members of your family where if you lose cell phone communication, members of the household or the family know where to report to in order to be counted for and in order to meet up again? So an evacuation plan, do you have that?
Okay.
Do you have an escape? escape plan if you have to escape, let's say, a fire or something in your house where you live at right now? Is there an escape plan or an evacuation plan that has been practiced and every member of the family knows what their job or responsibility is?
Okay.
Okay. Now, the next thing is any member of your family, do they have a medical condition where they are required to take prescription medication to maintain their health or mental health, physical health or mental health? Do you have an adequate supply of that medication stored up in your home? For instance, if a person is a diabetic and you lose electricity, how are you going to keep the insulin cool?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right. The last two questions. Do you have a fire extinguisher or fire extinguishers in your home, and does everyone in the home know how to use them to extinguish a fire? And the last one, do you have a utility wrench that you could use to shut off the gas and or the water to where you live at in case you needed to? Those are the 10 questions.
Okay. Wow. Okay. Now, I'm living in a cold zone. Lights are going out. There's no oil burning. What do I need to do to survive in that kind of climate in a disaster?
Well, again, depending on exactly where you're living, you need to find some kind of fuel source and some type of heat source that's not going to poison your environment and kill you. A lot of people, the first thing that they think of, oh, well, winter time is coming, let me put the plastic up to the window and duct tape the plastic to keep the draft out. But when you do that now, you suffocate yourself because there's no air, there's no fresh air in your environment now. And if you're cooking, you're releasing gas, you're releasing carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, so you're releasing poisonous gases into a confined space that you have the windows closed off with plastic and duct tape so it can't escape. It's going to kill you and every member of your family.
Okay. Okay. Talk to me about generators.
Okay, generators. Generators are excellent if you can afford them, if you can afford the fuel for them, and if you have adequate ventilation to run them. First of all, generators should never be run indoors. And if you are running a generator indoors, you need to make sure that you have adequate ventilation so that those fumes are not staying indoors and end up killing everyone. But yes, every home should have a portable generator so that you can have the very basic of lights, of maybe heat, or maybe, like I said, that diabetic that needs to keep that insulin cool, you can keep that refrigerator going.
Okay, okay. One second, Brother Rudolph. Brother Maurice,
yes,
are you there?
I am, dear brother. Assalamu alaikum.
Walaikum salam. We have on the line with us Chief Magistrate Court Justice Brother Maurice Muhammad from Alabama. You all are all out on the front line with the Fruit of Islam tonight. Brother Maurice, from what Brother Rudolph is talking about in a disaster, how does martial law apply to the movement of the people during a specific disaster like such a civil unrest or disaster?
Well, martial law primarily, dear brother, is constructed to either constrain the people or control the people. And basically martial law is brought into effect because of the unrest that usually a disaster, natural disaster creates. See, when natural disaster hits and the city government or the city police are either tied up with or confined dealing with local issues, then those major issues with individuals have to be dealt with another body. And that's when the federal troops are called in. That's when we call in our National Guard to come in and quote unquote protect the people. And usually martial law is set in on a very passive basis from the standpoint that it is not so much of the control factor in terms of the government is concerned, but more of the control factor of regulating the crowd control and increasing the presence of police presence, if you would, so that we won't have so much unrest, so that you won't have so much lawlessness. So you bring in troops with massive arms to deter that. And so usually in a martial law state, when a government or a governmental body declares a state of emergency, that is also a passive way of claiming a martial law, when you're setting aside the constitution of that particular city or the governmental right or the governmental authority of that particular city, and then you're mandating it back into the hands of the federal aspect, that's when martial law is beginning to take place. So at that point, the federal troops have more authority than the local troops. The federal troops actually command the local troops on how to move. So if you got a local police jurisdiction, then they will be under the authority of that National Guard unit. So they will actually be deputized on a national level or by the national level for that local rendering.
Okay. So now, Brother Rudolph is the first responder. He comes on the scene. Now, does martial law apply strictly for the disaster itself to maintain, like you said, the peace, so forth and so on, and the keeping of people from going in their homes or making them stay in their home, all that's determined by the federal troops?
All that is usually determined by the situation, more so than the federal troops. But because, you know, when you have situations where, for instance, in Birmingham, when we have a tornado here, you have families that could not enter into the area until certain credentials were brought up. And likewise, whenever you have a natural disaster, you have people that come in and actually take from the people who have been affected. And they're coming in to gain whatever they can gain, and we call it looters or vigilante steals or whatever you want to place it. But these people are coming in not to do the best, or they don't have the best motive in mind. So when they come in, they have to be regulated. So those troops would regulate those people that are coming in and out, but as a first responder, and I'm so glad that Brother Rudolph has his credentials as first responder, then you will have, because you have training. There's one thing, dear brother, to go into an area, to be going into an area because you're a good brother, but it's another thing to go into the area and actually know what to do once you get there. And
right.
I think that, you know, that's the purpose of being a first responder. You know how to, the process and the protocol of first finding out who's alive and finding those people who are living and then either removing them or bringing them to aid. But if you don't know what you're doing, you know, we're getting very emotional. We want to go to our uncle and our mother and all of these people, and now you will have chaos, or you will have the cans or the have versus the have not. You know, I saw during a tornado period where people had actually cash in their pocket, and they would pay people to come to pay them more attention in certain instances. So if we are not trained in that area on how to benefit our people, we'll fall for that every time. And that's just the nature of the beast and when you're dealing with that situation. So when you are in a natural disaster zone, you know, brother, I have to tell you that all bets are off. I mean, it is every man for himself and God for us all.
That's
because it is sheer panic.
Your phone sounds a little muzzled, Brother Maurice. You sound like you got a little muzzle over your phone.
You hear me better now?
Yes, sir. I can hear you better.
Yes, I was saying that when we're in natural disaster, it is pure panic. I mean, there's really no rationale. There's no point of order. Everybody's trying to simply survive. Everybody's next moment may be their last, and they deal with it like that. So one person
is
trying to get over another person, but if you are properly trained on how to deal with this, then you know about recovery and first of all going in with a reconnaissance unit and beginning to go and survey the area and see what areas are hit. Then you go in with another team to begin to extract those people from those areas, and then you go in with another layer and another tier of people with a different specialty. And see, this is one of the things that we've got to have in our community.
Right. Brother Rulo, who determines what communities get service first in a disaster? I'm asking the question for the listening audience, sir.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Okay.
I think there's probably no reason to even answer that question. We already know the answer.
Yes, sir.
What determines it? All right, let's keep this. You know what? Let's endeavor to keep this on a higher level.
Okay.
That question, that reality is determined by the political clout of that local community,
mm-hmm.
by the economic influence of that community, by the, what is the proper word I'm looking for? I don't want to say the color of the people in that community, because it may not necessarily be color, but it's definitely the socioeconomic status of the community. Because they could be poor black or poor white.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make a difference at that point if they are not affluent enough to command that the establishment acquiesces to them. Then they will be the last ones to be seen, to be taken care of.
Wow. Okay. Okay.
And
okay.
Rudolph, if I may add one also.
Yes, sir.
One of the things that I saw here in Alabama, and that is also the strategic demographic of that community, because there were some communities, just like in Louisiana during Katrina, that were already slated for demolition, if you would. And when the natural disaster came in, it was kind of almost like a perfect spin where you would come in and actually allow the natural disaster to do that, but you had no real intention on rebuilding in the first place.
That's correct.
Wow. Now, yes, sir, go ahead.
No, I was just saying that is correct.
Okay. You're out on the front line with the Fruit of Islam with Brother Rudolph Muhammad tonight and Brother Maurice Muhammad tonight. Brother Vernon, do we have any questions for our panel tonight?
There are a few more callers on the line. Let's see if we can bring in a caller from area code 256.
256, what say you, 256? 256. Wa alaikum salam.
This brother Anwar Amir, brother Maurice knows his dear brother.
Yes, brother Anwar. How you doing, soldier?
Brother, I'm doing fine.
Alabama.
All praises due to Allah.
Good to hear your voice, soldier. What can we do for you tonight?
I just want to let you know that I've been enjoying the call ever since Akbar started, and I'm just you know, I just want to learn more and seeing if is there any way of getting this to is there any way of you brothers getting this information sent to emails or maybe posting it on some type of website so that we can go on and look and share with our families and our communities.
Brother Rudolph?
Yes, sir, brother. That is a possibility. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. As a matter of fact, let me give you a website right now.
Yes, sir.
Go to Ready for Anything, readyforanything.org. readyforanything.org.
Yes,
sir. That is the website of the International Preparedness Network. Brother Eitan Edwards is the executive director, whom I worked very closely with, whom I've studied under and learned from. And Brother Eitan Edwards is a scientist by trade, by profession.
Wow.
He's a scientist that has dedicated his life to preparedness and trying to help the community.
Well, Brother Edwards, can I ask you a question? Did you take the test that Brother Rudolph just gave? Is Brother still online?
Yes, sir. Most definitely.
You took that test. How did you make out?
I did fairly well. I still had to work on some things, but some things I did not know that I needed.
Yes, sir. Praise be to Allah. Thank you for your call, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you. May Allah bless you.
May Allah bless you, too.
Okay. And
Brother Vernon.
We have one more caller.
Come on with it, Brother Vernon. What number?
This is a caller from 773.
773. What say you, 773?
It's Brother Rakib, brother. I'm still here listening to the show, Black man.
Yes, Brother Rakib,
you
got three different numbers on here, brother.
It's not the same, brother. Listen, I'm three-dimensional, Black man. Hey, anything that got to do with my people, I'm three-dimensional.
All right, I see you, brother Rakib hit us about four different ways to Sunday. I see.
Brother, you're doing a wonderful job, brother. You and Brother Jihad, brother. I'm enjoying myself. Brother Maurice, Brother Rudolph, brothers. I'm loving this, Black man. I'm loving this.
Praise be to Allah.
Great.
I got another question for you, Brother Rudolph. Out of all of those items that you named, what are you roughly looking at? For those items, I don't know, you may not know the information to this, but can you give us an estimation or a guesstimation, if you will, for a family of five, what are we looking at having to invest in something like this so that in case something like this happens in our neighborhood, we can survive for a week, say?
I wouldn't even be able to begin to put a price tag on it. Only because in the different regions and the different areas, you know, it's a different price scale. I'm up here in New York where it's an arm and a leg for everything.
Okay.
As opposed to other places where, you know, it may be quite reasonable. What I will say is this. Of what I talked about, the urgency and the urgent things are the water, the generator, and the food, because everything else you can make do with. You can make do with whatever clothing you have. You can make do with the supplies that you may have and stretch them, but you have to have that clean, fresh water to drink, to nourish your body. You have to have some good food to keep your body energized so that you can withstand the time frame. And then mainly you have to have something in there to occupy your mind and you a time, because those walls will start closing in on you, and psychologically, the families will begin to implode.
Mm-hmm. Well, Brother Maurice, talk to us about the disaster in Alabama, if you will. What were some of the major concerns that you saw that you could begin to work with right away?
Well, one of the things that I saw, number one, is that our community was so ill-prepared in terms of our basic communication base, our basic information. We had basically no information. We were simply just kind of winging it, and we were moving on the mainstream information, and when we were cut off from that information, we began to literally kind of, as they say, we began to go into one another. And so we began to, and I think one of the ways, or one of the ways that we can deal with that is that we can seek more certified training in disaster preparedness and really make this a mainstay of our community. You know, the young brothers who are on the corner, the young brothers who are hustling or whatever, rather than hustling on that end, begin to learn more about their communities and become more responsive to the communities and take those same soldiers that are on those corners and make them actual advocates for that community and advocates for our disaster preparedness. I think one of the things that we fell into is anytime you have a natural disaster like that, there are really no warning signs. You know, we probably had about 30 minutes notice and a third of a city was destroyed. You know, so it comes down just that quick, comes down just that fast, and we just have to really begin to work on a constant basis. It's nothing, you know, you can just hurry up and get ready for. It's something that you always have to be drilling for and training for and making a permanent part of your daily routine is to prepare for that moment.
That's correct.
The things that I saw in the community when we, our modes of transportation, we just got so tied up with cars and stuff, and so when the gas stations were hit and the power was out of the gas station, it was impossible for the pumps. So one of the things that knowing the messengers teaching in our survival kits, one of the major things is a bicycle. That was probably one of the greatest forms of transportation that we were able to use to get back and forth and begin to really communicate with other communities were our bikes. So we really need to really adhere to a lot of what the messenger has taught us about survival, even things that we have in our home, charcoal, pantyhose, all of these different household items that we have right now in our homes, how can we learn how to better utilize them in cases of emergency? How can we better utilize those household things that we already have? Because a lot of us don't necessarily have an area where we have what we have designated as a survival kit per se, but we still have a lot of items in our homes that comprise and make up those survival kits.
Okay. Okay, Brother Rudolph, let's go in an order like this. We talked about the different disasters based on the climate or where you're living, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, let's now look at California. What should I be concerned with in California?
Earthquakes.
Okay.
And depending on where in California, brush fires.
Who?
Fires.
Okay.
Forest fires. Yes.
Okay. Let's go to Texas.
Texas. Tornadoes.
Tornadoes. Okay. Let's come down. Let's pull them to the deep south. Let's say Louisiana, Mississippi.
Flash floods or any type of flooding, depending on what side of that thing you're on, hurricanes or tornadoes. And extreme weather.
Okay. Georgia, Alabama, South Carolina.
Same thing.
Say that again?
The same things. All throughout down there, it's the same things. It's hurricanes, tornadoes, extreme weather, and then also drought, depending on the time of year.
Okay. Let's come to Missouri, Oklahoma.
Okay, Tornado Alley. Tornado Alley, right through there. Yes, sir.
Okay, let's go to Florida.
Florida, again, would be floods. If you're on the coast, surges, tidal waves, you're talking about hurricanes, and you will also be looking at down around anywhere where it's very, very warm, you may end up with an infestation of insects.
Okay, let's go to Chicago, Michigan, Wisconsin, Indiana.
Okay, depending on the time of year, of course, we know, again, extreme weather, cold, snow, ice, tornadoes still, hurricanes, and all along there now, you really, really have to be concerned about earthquakes because they're happening on a regular basis, and they're happening so frequently. The magnitude is not what most people would think. It is going to destroy everything at once, you know, like a 7.0 or 8.0. But if you keep getting those threes and fours once and twice a week, it's loosening up the foundation enough that a high five will do the same thing. And the main thing throughout all of that area, you need to know whether you have a nuclear power plant that is in operation in that area, because if you do, then you are also being set up for a nuclear disaster or a biological or chemical disaster, because your power plants need fresh water to keep those reactors cool. And in the absence of fresh water, when those things heat up, they're going to start spewing out. And so it's going airborne, and it's going to just cover and blanket the area that you're in with radioactive material.
Yeah. Okay. New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Ohio.
The New Jersey, Pennsylvania, that whole area, Delaware Water Gap, all of that, is definitely flooding. It's coastline, so hurricanes, the Pennsylvania area, you know, you're talking about really in the mountains there. So ice, cool temperatures this time of year. You also, up in the Pennsylvania areas, you really want to look at this time of year, mudslides, landslides, things like that, because of the softening of the mountains, and depending on how moist they are, whatever is built on them may just be coming down.
Okay. Arizona, New Mexico.
Okay, the flatlands out there, okay, definitely the earthquakes, definitely the tornadoes out there, again with the heat and drought, the lack of water.
Okay, Utah, the Dakotas.
Again, moving back up that way, this time of year, temperature, cold, freezing temperatures, ice, preventing movement because of freezing the highways and the roads, power lines going down, loss of power, not being able to properly warm themselves or keep themselves warm, and then just being cut off and isolated from everybody with no communication.
Okay. So all of these different areas are different ways to prepare for them.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, how about maybe we get you to come back, beloved, and you can let us know, based on where they are, what they need. What they need to have stored. Okay, okay. We'll work on that because Santa Claus is in town next week. And he's going to take all the money. He's got a lot of traveling to do in 12 hours, so I'm going to make way for him. Now, let me say this, brother. This is a very, very serious subject, Brother Rudolph, and I know we kind of make light of it a little bit to lighten up the load, but I'm hoping that the listening audience is really listening. The Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad said that America was first on God's list to be judged, and he gave us the four great judgments that he would use.
That's right.
And so there's no such thing as it's not going to happen. He already told us it would happen. So what we need to be doing is preparing ourselves because these incidents are happening more and more every day. Yeah. Brother Rudolph, last comment. Would you like to say anything to the listening audience before you go out? We have roughly about 5 minutes for you. Say whatever on your mind. What is it you want to talk to the people about tonight, sir?
What I want the people to understand is that we have to take the onus on ourselves to protect our community. And the best way to protect our community is to make sure that each individual is trained and knowledgeable up to a basic level. So there should be no reason why every able-bodied man, woman, boy, and girl in our community does not know the very basics of CPR, basic first aid. With that being covered right there, that will help to sustain life during these times, but it will also help us to formulate disaster response teams in our community that will be able to go out and do these damage assessments and to know where our people are and know how to get to them and how to sustain and maintain life when these disasters strike. Go to on the website to www.SaveALifeRescueCPRMasters.com. www.SaveALifeRescueCPRMasters.com. That is my company's website. You can put your personal information in there, and we can get back to you. We can travel all over this country and teach, train, and certify people with the certifications necessary that when a disaster strikes, they will have the legal authority to be out in the streets amongst the people in order to help provide for their own people and their own community.
Beautiful. And I want you to know, brother, I have heard back from brother Captain, the student Captain Anthony, and I'm working on that with him right now to see if we can get some things done as a nation that can help our people. And I'll talk to you more about that off the air. Thank you, Brother Rudolph, for all that you do, sir. You have a thankless job. I understand what you go through. We don't do it for the thanks. But, brother, thank you anyway
for
being there. And we will definitely be doing some things together in the near future. This is a personal campaign that we are taking on boots on the ground. So we'll be working closer with Brother Maurice, yourself, and myself. And we're putting on a campaign to get this done now. So thank you again, beloved. Brother Maurice, Brother Maurice, you got about 3 minutes. Is there anything you want to talk to the people about before you go?
Well, I guess the only thing that I would have to say is, brothers and sisters, please get involved in disaster preparedness. because the life you save may be your own.
Yes, sir.
As we begin to put more information out, begin to take that information in and utilize it for your community. And you know your community better than anyone from the outside. And I would hate for us to be in a position where we are in our communities but have absolutely no authority and no power to do anything to help those people in our communities. And most times in natural disasters, we're not even allowed back into our communities to even salvage the couple of things that may be still available. So I think as we are preparing as we're preparing different vehicles to help us, as Brother Rudolph talked about, to help us certify, get involved. I think that's something that we can all do right where we are. We don't necessarily have to be in a certain post to save our life. I think if we really are about our community, we will actually invite people to get involved, whether in all of our civil organizations, our social organizations. Get them involved and really make this happen in our community, because we are in desperate need of that. And as brothers and sisters see with Sandy that happened up in New York and Katrina that happened in Louisiana and when Shock and Awe came through Alabama, as Flavor Flav and Chuck D said, hell no, we weren't all right. So, but we have to get together, make it happen for ourselves.
All right. All praise due to Allah. I want to thank the brothers for being out tonight, brother. I'm going to tell you something, brother. I learned a lot tonight, me personally. And I just want to say, brother, thank you again. These laws, Brother Maurice, I'm still not too clear. We're going to have to talk about this a little more on how some of these laws work. Yeah, because I'm really interested in that. How they apply, and what can we do as a community? Because, like you said, some communities get taken care of first, and other communities have to wait. And there's rapes and robbery and looting going on. So I definitely want to get back with you again on that. But we're off the air next week. But Allah willing, we got some things that we're working on, and so we'll get back to this again, Brother Rudolph and Brother Maurice. I want to thank both you brothers for being out tonight, and really I hope everybody took the exam so that you can see just how you would fare in an incident like this. So thank you all for coming out tonight. That's our show for tonight. We want to thank our guest, Abdul Akbar Muhammad, the international spokesman, representatives of the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, the Nation of Islam, disaster preparedness expert, Brother Rudolph Muhammad, and Chief Magistrate Court Justice, Brother Maurice Muhammad from Birmingham, Alabama. Remember to tune in every Sunday morning to the Nation of Islam webcast at Mosque Maryam by going to www.noi.org. And to purchase the Final Call newspaper along with DVDs and CDs, books of the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad and the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, go to store.finalcall.com. On Twitter, the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan said these words: when you conquer the enemy within, no enemy outside of you is more powerful or is able to weaken you. Original salute to the Supreme Captain of the Nation of Islam, Mustafa Farrakhan, to all the soldiers. Don't forget to support the National Defense Fund, because the fruit of Islam is the backbone of the Nation of Islam. And it is our duty to defend, protect, and serve our nation. So don't forget to support our national defense.